You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, April 29th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, David Dayen on the latest attempts, and probably successful, by the Treasury Department of the Obama administration to thwart any meaningful reform of the too-big-to-fail banking industry. Folks, I cannot tell a lie. I said we were live today. That is only partially the case. In fact, I am recording this early this morning. I mean, recording it now, but relative to the time that you're hearing it, I recorded it Monday morning. Matt and Michael will be doing the second half of the program today. Unfortunately, I need to travel out of town for a funeral. A friend of the family. I appreciate your condolences. I will be back later this week. However, I will leave you in the increasingly capable hands. Everything's relative. But, I mean, increasingly capable hands of Matt and Michael, who will, like I say, provide you with the better half today and content tomorrow, Tuesday, and on Wednesday. And I shall return on Thursday. Folks, great time to remind you, it's your support that makes this program possible. You can become a member at majority.fm. Buy your Amazon crap through our Amazon link. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade. Coffee, tea, or chocolate. I don't say pow and blah, 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 and get on and talk to Charlie Rose. I don't do all that. But even still, support this program. Also, on another note, I got another letter telling me that podcasts are apparently patented. The idea of doing a serialized audio content and distributing it in a push methodology that ends up on someone's personal media player apparently is an idea that someone had in 96 and they patented. And now I don't know. I mean, for all I know, I also get emails from people saying that there is millions of dollars in a bank in Nigeria that is just waiting for me. And all I need to do is send $6,000 so that the lawyer can go ahead with the paperwork. Now, to be fair, this Nigerian situation, it sounds a little dubious to me, at least ethically. I mean, this isn't my money. It is, of course, the money of a relative of one of the Prince of Nairobi, who died in a plane crash. And the money's in there, and there's some bank directors in Nigeria who, of course, just being like bank directors, and they will not release this money. And my good friend, who is apparently the manager of this bank in Nigeria.
Joffe Jofer.
Joffe Jofer, or I think his name is Bill Thompson, who studied at Oxford, he needs a representative from the United States to subsidize just to get this money out there, and he is being incredibly generous in terms of a finder's fee for me. Almost embarrassing how much
really
money, because I'm not doing much.
Change CPI take
yes.
on the show.
And he is being incredibly generous and almost to the point where I feel guilty taking this much.
To be fair, though, whatever work you are doing for him, it's at least more work than what the patent people did.
Well, I mean, they're going through the time. Who knows? So all I'm saying is that I don't know. Someone who has my address purports to saying that I owe them money. So, folks, just to give you a sense of if it's not enough that I am attempting on a daily basis to bring you the best analysis and the best interviews and then simultaneously juggling two children, literally, and the first one is extremely heavy to juggle now. The second one's very light. And but all that, and still with a mild, almost imperceptible smile on my face. So if you can afford to support the program, please do. In the meantime, we're going to take a break. When we come back, David Dayan, and then I will be back on Thursday. Matt and Michael will be taking care of your audio needs that once we produce it, we have no idea what happens, really. We don't know who plays it on what. And, you know, I have no idea. It's a mystery to me. We simply sign up with services that charge us money. I wonder, actually, now wait a second. If that's illegal, can I sue somebody now for taking my money to provide a service that they didn't? Maybe I'm onto something. Maybe I'm onto a new revenue source.
Maybe you get some of those big bucks from Apple.
I can't. Well, I'm going to sue Apple right now. Or I'm just going to go and have an apple for lunch today.
Either or.
Either or. All right,
folks.
You
can guess which one.
Right.
A little column A, a little column B.
Yes. I'll take a little bit of. All right, folks. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to the program David Dayan, independent journalist and writing now for, well, I mean, you've been writing for everybody, but your latest piece is in the American Prospect, essentially on the Treasury Department's, well, it seems like their intense reluctance to really provide any meaningful regulation for banks. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
All right, so let's start first with the Brown-Vitter banking bill, which has been introduced in the Senate. Tell us about that bill and why it's needed, despite the fact that we have this wonderful Dodd-Frank.
Right. It's officially known as the Terminating Bailouts for Taxpayer Fairness Act, or the TBTF, which also is an acronym used for Too Big to Fail Act. And really what it would try to do is end this practice of banks being too big to fail, enjoying subsidies from the marketplace because they can borrow funds at a cheaper rate based on the perception that investors will never lose anything because banks will be bailed out if they ever get into trouble. So they borrowed at a cheaper rate than their smaller rivals. They're incentivized to take on more risk. They threaten the economy, and then they get a bailout afterwards. So the idea is to guard against that. And Brown Vitter mainly does that through the imposition of additional capital requirements. And what that means is that the case today is it kind of depends on what you look at in terms of accounting standards. But for every $100 that a bank lends out, 97 of those dollars they cover through other borrowing, and only about $3 or so do they cover through selling stock or retaining their earnings. So that's a 3% capital ratio. That's really the case. If you look at an apples-to-apples comparison, if you look at the accounting standard that they go by in Europe and the rest of the world, that's pretty much it. Now, there were international accounting standards put in a process in Basel, Switzerland, that would increase those capital standards to roughly 7 or 8%, but there's some accounting games being played there, as I'll get into later. what Brown Vitter would do...
And we should say that's known as Basel 2 or 3?
3. That would be Basel 3. America is still implementing Basel 2, by the way. But what Brown Vitter would do would be to throw out that process, actually, and move to a very hard capital standard of 8 to 10% for smaller banks and a 5% capital charge for any bank that has over $500 billion in assets. That includes the five largest banks in America, which control or hold about 63% of GDP in their assets. So those banks would have a surcharge and would have a 15% capital standard. So for every $100 they lend out, they would have to have $15 in stocks or retained earnings. And that means if the value of their assets go down, they can cover it through their own funds, through the stock or the capital retained capital earnings. Instead of having to go for a bailout, it prevents the need for a bailout because the bank has to cover their own mistakes rather than going to the government
now,
looking for them to cover them.
Forgive me. I want to get just a little remedial here so that people really understand what's going on. When you have the bank is basically making these bets or loans in some respects.
And some that might be a better term.
That's what it is. Every time somebody loans you money, they're making a bet that you're going to be able to pay it off and that they're going to make money off of the interest rate. And how risky a bet you are to pay it off is reflected in how big of an interest you are charged. And people understand this, and if you have bad credit, then your interest rate's going to be higher than it would be otherwise. And so this is what's going on here. And this is to prevent, if too many of those bets go south, that the banking institution is left without enough money to cover those bets, essentially.
Right. Basically, the way it is right now, something like a 3.7% drop in the value of the assets of the bank would mean that the bank is insolvent. It would mean that they don't have the funds on hand, the liquid assets, to actually cover those losses. And one of the reasons for that is that the banks will tell you that they're very healthy and very well capitalized. But there's this element known as risk weighting. And this is a very important point, that under the Basel process, under the current American standard, banks are allowed to change how much capital they need based on the perceived risk of the asset. And if they have what are known as less risky assets. They can risk weight their capital so that they actually have less capital, but they claim that it's more because these assets aren't risky. Now, what we saw during the financial crisis is that assets that were seen as AAA, these mortgage-backed securities that were rated by credit rating agencies as super safe assets, ended up losing lots and lots of money. So the idea that they were less risky, which is what they would be seen to be if they were AAA assets, didn't matter in the context of a financial crisis. So this is the main problem with the Basel process and the current process. And Brown-Vitter gets rid of risk weighting altogether. It now says you have a certain amount of assets, you have a certain amount of liabilities, and this ratio is the ratio that we're going to use.
Right. You cannot massage that dynamic by claiming, hey, we loan the money to Sam's producer, Matt Bender. He's really good for it. So it doesn't, we may have loaned him $100, but we're just going to count it as $50 because he's so good for this money.
Exactly.
And now, of course, we know what happened during the financial crisis. All of these rock-solid loans and bets and derivatives and obviously we're simplifying this dynamic a little bit because the bank then turns around and sells the debt and its
right.
performance of this debt is a function of what they can get for this debt, et cetera, et cetera. But we're simplifying it here. But that's the right. basic gist of it.
Yeah, and the important thing to know is that Brown-Vitter gets rid of risk weighting, and it says that you have to, in reality, show in your books that you have this percentage available to you to cover losses that you take. There are some other things in Brown-Vitter, but really the main thing is that it's capital requirements that are heavily boosted that will make the system much safer and will require less of a need to even think about bailouts because banks would have to cover their own losses.
Before we get into the question as to whether or not this is redundant with Dodd-Frank, the reaction of obviously the big banks to this and their lobbyists in the form of the U.S. Treasury Department. Let's just talk about this piece of legislation in and of itself. Is this a good piece of legislation? In other words, does this go far enough? Putting aside for a moment the likelihood this gets passed, is this a good piece of legislation in terms of doing what it sets out to do?
Yeah, I think capital requirements are an important part of any stable banking regime. And there are articles and books out there. There's a book by two professors, Martin Helwig and Anat Admati, called The Banker's New Clothes, which I highly recommend, which has even higher recommendations for capital ratios. But this would certainly do a lot to focus on a very pure standard, very simple standard that even these regulators could figure out, I think, that would make the system safer. It would allow banks to only take risks that they could cover, really, with existing capital. There are other things in the law, as I said, where you could prohibit, the Federal Reserve would have to prohibit non-depository institutions that don't get insurance from the FDIC, they don't take deposits, from access to all of their lending sources, cheap lending sources, the discount window, and all these federal support programs. So basically it would wean off these non-depository institutions from the safety net that has been built for banks and only allow those banks that have, individual deposits to take advantage of those resources. So that also would tend to make the banks a little bit safer. It would essentially say that if you want to take these risks, you can. You just aren't going to get access to all of these special gifts and resources from the federal government as a result. So that's another part of Brown-Vitter. Overall, there are some things in there that show the power of the community banks, because they would have a lot of their regulatory burden lessened under this law. Not a lot, but a certain amount at least. We have a system that has incented big banks for so long. This is an example of the community banks getting a little bit back in the game. And they're not only would their capital burden be lower, but it would reduce certain regulatory requirements on community banks. So overall, I think the law is important. I don't know that it's the only law that you need to ensure stability and safety in the financial system and prevent future bailouts, but it's an important component.
And would the effect of this law be essentially to break up these banks? I mean, in other words, will this create a playing field essentially that no longer makes it worth them being so large?
It certainly could. Goldman Sachs issued a report that said it would. Standard & Poor's issued a report that said it probably would as well. It would have the equivalent of forcing the raising of $1.1 trillion of extra capital for these large financial institutions. And they might not want to do that. They might want to split up their component parts and get under that, I believe, $500 billion threshold where they don't get hit with the extra capital surcharge. And if they do that, it's not only about reducing size, but it's reducing the risk appetite for these banks, because above the $500 billion threshold, they now have to be much more conservative. They have to take in a lot more capital. And so you're not only reducing size, but you're reducing the risk in the system. And that's pretty much the important thing, I think, to understand, is that what we want is a financial system that's less likely to just go haywire. And increasing these capital requirements is a large step in the right direction.
Okay, so the bill sounds like it's a good idea, and it will never happen. Tell us why.
Right, exactly. Even though it is, as we've been saying, bipartisan, you have these strange bedfellows, David Vitter, Republican from Louisiana, Sherrod Brown, Democrat from Ohio. The missing component in that is support from the executive branch. And what we saw is a week before Brown-Vitter was released, Mary Miller, who is the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance, she's a holdover from the Geithner era, and she still works at the Treasury Department in a very high capacity, gave a formal speech to a group called the Hyman Minsky Conference, which is at a Bard College, I believe. And she basically said that Dodd-Frank already solved the too-big-to-fail problem, that there are already robust capital requirements in the system, that it's unclear whether or not there is a subsidy for big banks by virtue of their size and the perception of a bailout, perception of too big to fail. And basically, everything's fine, let us implement Dodd-Frank, let's go home. That was basically the message of Miller's speech. And it was a big formal speech given in a public setting a week before a bill that, you know, envisioned larger capital requirements, more financial regulation, was about to be released. You can't see it as anything but a rebuttal or a pre-buttal to that law, to that bill being dropped. And it basically says that, as Neil Barofsky, the former Special Inspector General for TARP, told me, it basically says that when it comes to regulatory reform, the shop is closed. Treasury does not believe there's a problem, and they're not going to want any further financial regulation to be contemplated.
Now let's talk about these the supposed reasons why Brown-Vitter is superfluous. First off, in terms of Dodd-Frank, I mean, on this program we've talked about it. I think you and I have talked about it in the past. Dodd-Frank, in many ways, does not really exist yet. I mean, some parts of it do, but it is constantly being litigated literally in the courts, courts that are controlled by conservatives who are very hostile to regulation. We have seen element after element of Dodd-Frank undercut both on a both in terms of the rulemaking process from where it starts, and then it gets even more debilitated. And the perception that it's going to get debilitated in the courts has essentially really sort of taken, I mean, not just softened out the rough edges of Dodd-Frank, but really taken a lot of the teeth out of it.
Right. And that's those are the rules that have actually been promulgated. I believe the number is about one third of Dodd-Frank rules have actually been implemented at this point, which means two thirds have not. And this is almost 3 years after the law was passed, and deadlines for regulatory agencies to write the rules have been missed time and again. And so it wasn't really a law. It was a promise to write a law. And what I'm saying is two-thirds of that law has not yet been written. So we don't know what Dodd-Frank is going to do. And of course, many of the things that Mary Miller cites haven't been used at all, things like resolution authority. If a bank gets into trouble, they have now this allegedly orderly process that the FDIC can go in, even if it's a large institution, and put it into receivership and do the things that it does with smaller institutions. Well, we have no idea if that's going to work or not. And in fact, the idea of a large international bank that has a global reach and all of this interconnectedness can just be orderly resolved in an orderly fashion is you know, to at least many critics, just chimerical. That there is no possibility that this is going to be done in an orderly fashion. There's the issue of living wills, which is another thing Mary Miller brings up, that the banks are supposed to give a roadmap essentially for how to unwind them if they get into trouble. It's called the living will process. Well, the living wills have been completely inadequate. They've been a joke at this point. In fact, the FDIC and the Federal Reserve, who are managing the living will process, key officials have said that they're going to take action against the banks if they don't give them something reasonably adequate in terms of living wills in the next, I believe the deadline is October. So the idea that these kinds of laws are protecting the system right now is just fantastical. We don't know. We have no idea. And in fact, what we've seen so far shouldn't inspire a lot of confidence.
So far, what we have in terms of Dodd-Frank, to the extent that any of these have been implemented, is essentially a structure in which to send the ambulance for the patient, essentially, as opposed
right.
to prevent the need for the ambulance.
That's correct. And I believe what Mary Miller would tell you is that, well, the Basel III process, which we discussed before, includes a lot more capital requirements, and the banks are well capitalized, and we did these stress tests that show that even in an adverse scenario, banks would still be solvent. And no harm, no foul. What you have to understand is that Miller's main talking points, everything that she discussed in this large speech, which you can find on the Treasury Department's website, it all mirrors a series of reports put out by the financial industry directly to rebut Brown-Vitter. And these reports come from the likes of Goldman Sachs. They come from the Financial Services Forum, which is a large trade group, and they come from this thing called Hamilton Place Strategies, which is essentially a PR firm that has the big banks as clients. And it's run by the last three communications directors for the last three Republican presidential nominees. So whatever Mary Miller is trying to peddle, she just know that she's peddling the exact same things that the financial industry has been peddling when they've been trying to react to Dodd-Frank and this, or not Dodd-Frank, but Brown-Vitter and this sort of bipartisan movement to break up the banks, restrict their size, restrict their power, restrict their influence.
Well, all right. To be fair, you're probably pretty busy if you're in her position. And so you may only have time to cut and paste certain things if you've got to come up with a speech. But more seriously, she also cites I suspect she would also say, well, the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule also helps in this regard in terms of preventing banks from overextending themselves. But the Volcker Rule is just like the rest of Dodd-Frank. It doesn't really exist yet. The idea of it exists, but how the rubber meets the road doesn't really exist yet, does it?
It doesn't exist at all. Treasury has not finalized the rule. The interagency process has not come to a conclusion. And we know this because J.P. Morgan Chase last year, with the fail whale trades, basically did something that could have been illegal under the Volcker Rule, but we have no idea because there is no Volcker Rule at this point. So, citing that, which he did, is not something that we should take seriously.
So, in some respects, it seems like at this point that Dodd-Frank has basically become this sort of straw man or straw law that is used essentially more effectively to prevent any further reform than to actually engage in actual reform.
What you should know is that in these various bank and bank lobbyist reports, the fact that all of them, to a man, say that we don't need this new large capital requirement, which is going to restrict lending and hurt the economy, because Dodd-Frank is already doing that work. The fact that banks are saying this, banks who fought Dodd-Frank tooth and nail during the legislative process and continue to fight it during the regulatory process, that should tell you pretty much all you need to know, that the banks are the ones saying, no, don't worry, Dodd-Frank solved everything. We're much safer now.
So
that should pretty much give away the game right there.
Okay, so we have the White House, at least the administration, coming out in a sort of pre-buttal to this Brown-Vitter piece of legislation. What is the support? I mean, do you have a sense of what the support is in the Senate and in the House for this legislation? I mean, are we going to see, is it even going to get a vote? Is there going to be some type of debate, or is it just sort of dead on arrival?
I don't think it'll get a vote. What you saw was, predictably, when the executive branch says, give Dodd-Frank a chance to be implemented, now that's exactly what, for example, the head of the Senate Banking Committee, Tim Johnson, is saying, that we should give the Dodd-Frank rules a chance to work, a chance to be implemented, and we shouldn't contemplate a new overhaul of these rules before that time. So that's going to be the talking point, that Treasury wants time for this to work, and so we'll have to give it to them.
Has anybody stated a timeline? I mean, when we say time for this to work, I mean, it's been 3 years. We don't even have
exactly.
The laws aren't even written
yet. I don't know that
there's
a timetable when that's said. But one timetable that you can look at is the fact that Tim Johnson is retiring. And he retires in 2014. And basically, if things fall the way they probably should, Sherrod Brown, who's the co-sponsor of this Brown-Vitter law, proposed law, would be the head of the Senate Banking Committee. Now, at that point, the context changes a little bit. And if Sherrod Brown has the power as the head of the Banking Committee to move laws, he's probably going to do it. So it may be a good thing that you're not going to see this for a couple of years. I mean, it's bad because you still have a lot of risk in the system. But Sherrod Brown will be much more well-positioned should Democrats hold the Senate and he arise to the chairman's position at the Senate Banking Committee. And it gives it more time. I mean, I think the best thing about this proposal is that it puts something on the shelf.
Right.
When we were in 2008, there was nothing on the shelf to deal with this financial meltdown, and so what we got was a series of bailouts. So now we're more educated about the problems in the financial system, and this would be on the shelf as an alternative to the theory that all we can do is just a bunch of new bailouts and you know, keep the system as it is.
I don't think
this is the alternative vision.
I don't think the value of having solutions drafted as bills, basically at the ready, in order to deal with crises as they come up, I don't think that can be overstated. And I think that's something that has really yet to seep in. I mean, you know, the right and the corporate forces have built a whole sort of ocean of legislation preparing for crisis points, preparing for opportunities, whether it's, you know, sort of ALEC and their model legislation waiting for a wave of Republicans taking over state legislatures. This is really crucial in that regard. Who, in the event that the Democrats lose the Senate, who would be the Republican chair of the Banking Committee? And is that would that be basically the death knell for this legislation?
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, that would be, I believe, Mike Crapo, who's a senator from Idaho, and he's already on the record against this process. But I will say that one interesting part of Brown Bitter, obviously, is its bipartisan nature. And as I wrote in a previous article for the American Prospect, we're seeing a movement that's bipartisan to deal with the problems in the financial system, and particularly among conservative academics, not just sort of the Tea Party rank and file, but among, you know, people in think tanks, pundits, people like George Will and Peggy Noonan, people at the American Enterprise Institute, several facets of that conservative movement ecosystem has admitted that the banks are too big to fail, that they enjoy these subsidies, and that this is an example of what they call crony capitalism, where the government is sort of propping up these banks and they want to put a stop to it. So there are points of congruence there that are transpartisan, and I think that will help, particularly in the event of a crisis, to regardless of who controls the chambers.
All right. So lastly, let me just ask you, not directly related, but an interesting development in terms of when we talk about committees and who chairs them. Max Baucus has announced that he really wants to get into lobbying before all the money dries up. I don't know if that's exactly what his speech was, but
I don't think that was verbatim.
I don't. That's not quite verbatim, but I can understand the dynamic as I watch producers go on from this program to to wonderful careers. One starts to wonder, wait, what, maybe, you know, Baucus having
they actually call the Majority Report, I think it's nicknamed the K Street Project.
That's right.
Because that's pretty much a pipeline.
Exactly. And Baucus comes in a close second in terms of producing the most amount of lobbyists on K Street of any other sort of public institution, I think, in the country. All right. But be that as it may, he is leaving. Of course, this is the committee, the Finance Committee, which basically it deals with just about everything, it seems to me, that is relevant. Ron Wyden is set to be the chair. Well, tell me what the implications are from your perspective of this, assuming the Democrats hold the Senate.
Yeah, there are a lot of implications. I mean, the first thing is that Chuck Schumer is really first in line for both banking and finance, and he can't do both. He probably will do neither because he wants to maintain his leadership position. And that means that you get Wyden at finance and Brown at banking. But even if Chuck Schumer is encouraged by you know, lobbyists or some other forces saying that we can't let you know, these committees get out of control, he can't do both. So the good news here is that you're either getting Brown at banking, Wyden at finance, or both. As far as Wyden is concerned, obviously there's going to be a sea change if you're going from Max Baucus to Ron Wyden, who also, you know, I mean, one of the knocks on Max Baucus in recent years was that he tried to get a bipartisan process for the health care bill, and he spent months trying to bring along people like Chuck Grassley. Wyden does have that bipartisan streak in him. He, you know, he created Wyden-Bennett, which was a bipartisan health care bill, and he's done that on a number of other grounds, including getting in a lot of trouble with liberals when he partnered with Paul Ryan on this sort of premium support idea, although he disavowed the Ryan budget eventually. So there, you know, I think Wyden will frustrate some liberals at some level more than is being said here sort of in the preliminary discussions about it. But it'll be an interesting committee. I mean, Wyden is interested in a lot more innovative kinds of issues, I think, than what we've normally seen on the Finance Committee, which is take whatever K Street's giving you and run with it. He is currently the chair of the Energy Committee, so I think he'll have a focus on that. And, you know, it certainly means some interesting stuff in the areas of health care and potentially in the area of taxes.
All right. Well, David Dayan, thanks for that that analysis, and I appreciate your talking about this piece. In terms of bank reform, I'm seeking encouragement wherever I can find it. I'm encouraged that at least that this legislation, or the bill anyways, exists for what I perceive to be a fairly inevitable need for it in the, hopefully in the far distant future, but who knows. And it's good that it exists in the event that that takes place. David Dayan.
Right, and
go ahead.
The other thing I would say is that, you know, a groundswell of support obviously helps anything move in Congress. And so if you like the idea that the banks would need to cover their own losses, tell your member of Congress that they should get on board with Brown Bidding.
All right. David Dayan, thanks so much. Folks, we will link to that piece on the Majority.fm website. David Dayan, always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the better half. Just I mentioned this up front, just a little bit of house cleaning, housekeeping. I will be Matt and Michael are going to be doing the better half of the program today. I need to travel down to Florida for a funeral. I will be back on Thursday. In the meantime, Matt and Michael will provide some content for you on Tuesday and Wednesday. You can support this program, and I guess this is a good time. I think I may have mentioned it earlier, but I got another letter, and I don't know how many days we are from getting sued or not getting sued, but there is a desire to sue us for doing a podcast. And so your support of this program will help keep it alive, even in the event that we are sued and have to reconvene as something different. Who knows? But you can become a member at majority.fm. We really need your support, obviously. As you know, we make millions of dollars in revenue on this program. Hundreds of millions of dollars, but of course we're sending so much of that in knapsacks and duffel bags to Afghanistan to support the Karzai regime that there's very little left sitting around the office. It's always amazing. We put all of our money, not necessarily onto the screen, but into the Karzai regime. All right, folks. Again, I will be back on Thursday. Matt and Michael will be taking over for the next couple of days. See you then.
That's right, folks. Matt and Michael here.
And this is not a pre-record. This is us speaking to you live.
We're live. We're back. We're headed into the better half of the show. We got a lot of stories for you.
We got a lot of great stuff coming into the better half.
We're going to be talking about the right wing pushing us to intervene in Syria. We're going to be talking about...
We are going to talk about the first major professional athlete to come out of the closet that just happened today.
Amazing story.
It's a great story.
What a brave, unbelievable guy. Obviously, your phone calls, your IMs, you can call us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Libertarians, obviously, more than welcome to try to take us on if you think you have an opening with Sam being away.
Oh.
Obviously, you don't. So we're cold.
Not obviously. That's why it's good, because we hit them with the 1-2, and they're not expecting it.
I think that we've done it enough already that maybe they're expecting a little bit more.
I'm
but
sure
you know what? Guys, but they call and they think they're going to knock out Freedom, but they're going to knock Sam out with that Freedom uppercut. So look at us. We're welterweights, guys. We're not heavyweights like Sam. Come take a shot at us with your best libertarian nonsense.
You hit us with that Freedom uppercut and we'll bash you over the head with a regulation clothesline.
I like it. All right. See you in a minute on the Better Half.